This episode is sponsored by Charlie HR, the HR software your team will actually love. Both Rich and I use it for our businesses, and they can do everything from tracking time off, making it easy for employees to request and managers to approve, automatically keeping track of time off allowances so no more annoying spreadsheets, which everyone hates, and it even integrates into your company calendar and Slack for visibility of who's away and when.
Yeah, it's especially great for onboarding new members of your team because it collects all the personal information you need. It also gives you this great team directory, allowing everyone to see a list of employees. We've also been using it recently for performance reviews and training, as well as key dates, birthdays, and appraisals. It's just great that everything is finally in one place.
The main point is building a business is bloody hard and running one shouldn't be. So if you're looking to improve your HR processes and just make the whole experience of running a company that little bit easier, check out the beautifully designed charliehr.com. It's completely free to get up and running, so go do it today. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Whatever time it is, wherever you are in the world, we're going to presume it's in the UK, and we're going to presume that it's you participating in and enjoying a rainy August.
Before we get going, we actually have quite a lot of audience in Africa. Looking at the stats, yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah, so you can't presume that we have an audience in the UK.
Interesting. Okay, well, okay. Let's presume that it's very hot in Africa, very rainy in August in Britain.
It is.
And wherever you've got your eyes set and wherever you might be going this August, with this podcast in your ears, we've got the perfect travel companion for you on episode 12. Tamara Lorne is the co-founder of Mr. and Mrs. Smith Hotels. Mr. and Mrs. Smith, for those that are in the know, curate the best hotels and hotel experiences in the world. And they have offices now, I think, in London, LA, Australia, all over the place, right?
Yeah.
A few in Asia? You didn't listen to the interview,
no,
you don't know.
I have listened, I've edited it, but I'm actually just quickly Googling whether they do that. But what's the other interesting fact about Tamara is the fact she started the business with her husband.
Very true, it's absolutely a Mr. and Mrs. Smith, although technically it'd be a Mr. and Mrs. Lorne, I think. Is that correct?
Yes.
That's not even his surname,
no,
is it?
No, it's not. No, it's Lorne.
Yeah, it is. Okay, well, you can see we did our research.
Do you know why they would call it Mr. and Mrs. Smith?
No, tell us.
So you weren't even listening to the interview.
No.
Mr. and Mrs. Smith was the name they came up because when couples went away, kind of snuck away,
yes,
they booked under the name Mr. and Mrs. Smith. So it was kind of like a dirty weekend kind of thing.
It's very
true. You obviously haven't ever been on a dirty weekend.
Anyway, without further ado, we're going to let you listen to the very lovely and very impressive Tamara Lorne. And in this week's episode, what you're going to learn about is how not to do a job straight out of uni and get sent off to Brazil for all sorts of craziness, and how to definitely start a business with your husband and make it purely successful year on year. A fun fact about Tamara, she is the CTO of the company, and going against gender stereotypes, if the sky doesn't work in the house, her husband calls her and gets her to fix it. But she's obviously capable of a lot more than that, so sit back, listen, and enjoy.
From Runway East Studios in London, welcome to The Secret Lives of Leaders.
So, another day, another guest with an MBE. Though what's nice this time round is that our guest ticks a lot of other boxes too. Tamara Lorne, the co-founder of Mr. and Mrs. Smith Hotels, is in fact the CTO of the company. And while she has claimed to me quite a few times that her husband is in fact the driving force and personality behind the brand, it's hard to imagine that's not just her being modest. She started Mr. and Mrs. Smith with her husband James 14 years ago, and has been at the heart of one of the best-loved internet brands in Britain. But in fact, it started out as a publishing business. A guide for people who, like her, wanted to explore the luxury boutiques across the country and discovering the real gems and stylish weekends away in unique hotels. They sold 10,000 copies in their first 6 weeks, but fast forward to today, they have over 100 staff spread across London, LA, Singapore, New York and others, and have had contributions from celebrities ranging from Stella McCartney to Kate Blanchett. So it's a pleasure to be with you here today. And actually, I confess, although very different, we've taken a lot of inspiration from Mr. and Mrs. Smith at Grabble, which I think I've told you in the past, mm-hmm. which of course is actually how I first met you when I cornered to ask you all about curation at an event, as you might remember or might have nightmares over, I'm not sure. hopefully this is a much less forced conversation and I don't have anything prepared in that sense. So to crack on with it, welcome to our very esteemed guest. So hi, Tamara.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Pleasure. Can I call you Tam? Do I call you Tamara or Mara? What is it?
A Tam is great. That's Tam. What I usually get called.
And let our listeners know how you just corrected me on our surname so they never do the same again.
Lorne is Lohan, but it's the Irish version, I guess.
So Lauren. Good.
Lauren.
So Rich isn't the biggest fan of these icebreakers that I put together, but as he's not here today, I get to do whatever I like, so I put them in anyway.
Your prerogative.
Exactly. And then when he edits them, obviously I'm very aware that he can just edit them straight out, so let's hope that they're good. Okay, most important question, cats or dogs?
Dogs.
Oh, wrong. Never mind. So you've got a burning building and you can only take three items out with you. And yes, your kids and your husband and your pets are all fine. So maybe start with your home insurance certificate. But what else are you going to take out with you?
Well, I shouldn't need a home insurance certificate because that will be all online.
Correct. Good. So you've still got three spaces then.
Yeah, I have. Snacks for the kids, because I know they're going to be on the street whining. Yeah.
Well, it's clear you don't have any Picassos at home then, if snacks was the first thing you went to.
I'm thinking of art. There is one painting I would take, which hangs in our sitting room, and it is of a lady. We bought it, the artist is called Desiree, and we bought it on our honeymoon. And it kind of dominates the whole of the sitting room. She's very serene. And when I had my babies, as babies, I used to just kind of walk them around the room. And every time we passed the painting, they would calm down.
Oh, really?
And kind of stare into this face.
It's got like a mystical quality to it.
It does. So that would definitely be number two. Number three. So the phone is covered or not? Did you say?
The phone's in your pocket.
In my pocket. Okay. Do you know what? I'm not that materialistic. Yeah. I would have to say.
What about an original
not
book?
Bothered.
An original. You must have one
or
of your
on
original
my Kindle.
Books. No, your own original Mr. and Mrs. Smith hotel book. You must have that at home.
Yeah, we have lots of them in the office. We have one on the wall. It was 007 off the print run.
Okay.
Yeah, instead of
so,
number one,
so you
we
might
got
take that.
We got number seven. Yeah, I guess.
Sure, why not? You've run out of things. I feel like, you know, if we keep on pushing you, you're going to be like, I don't know, a pan, my favourite pan.
Do you know what? I'm not. My husband and I are not materialistic people. I mean, we like nice things, but at the end of the day, I could up sticks and go
yep.
live anywhere.
Okay.
And I guess
digital
that's
nomad.
The traveller in me. Yeah. Yeah,
makes sense. So, speaking of the traveller in you, London or New York?
New York.
Oh, really? Very quick to say so as well, but you live in London, so what's
the deal?
Only
because I'm in London. If I was in New York, it would be London.
Oh, I see. Okay, so another insight into you want what you can't have or don't have.
I guess I'm always... So if I look at the year when we come into January and I go, where am I going? And if I don't have... At any time during the year, if I don't have several things booked and planned to go away, I get utterly... desolate and depressed.
Oh, interesting. Okay. You're definitely in the perfect business.
Yes, for me, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so the best experience money can buy in the best hotel chain in the world or a curated stylish weekend in a more boutique hotel?
Number two.
Is it actually though?
Yes.
If I really push you, like the best ever most premium experience in the biggest chain.
I just don't like chains.
Okay, cool. I'm just checking.
They leave me cold.
Okay. Do you ever stay in them? Are you ever... for example, when you go travelling to people...
To.
Yeah. Do people force you to?
So I do some speaking engagements. And occasionally when I do like a big marketing conference in Berlin or something like that...
Yeah.
I will try to stay in one of our hotels. But generally... forced to on
okay.
those occasions.
All right, so raise millions and own less of your own company but grow super fast, or grow more organically on less money but have more control and ownership?
Oh, now there's a really good question.
What did you do?
So I think we have raised money
yep.
through Smith, and we have grown, and we have seen, you know, periods of extreme growth over a 14-year period.
Sure.
We're not a startup anymore.
Yeah.
So we have seen periods of extreme growth and then slowing offs. And so it all depends on, you know, what your idea of a lot of money is. For us, we've had about 5 million invested. And I would say that's not a lot of money.
No,
but for some people, that would be, sure, know, that would be more.
Well, certainly not a lot of money for the size of your brand, that's for sure.
So I guess we've done it. You could say that we've done it organically. We've done it organically.
That's, to me, I would argue that that's organically. Yeah. Okay, so sell out or profitably maintain your lifestyle?
Well, we are right now profitably maintaining our lifestyle.
Sure.
Which then gives you the beautiful opportunity to answer exactly the same question. So what you know or what you don't know?
I think for both my husband and I, at some point we will want to do something else. So, and because we have shareholders, there will be an exit at some stage.
Yeah.
So because they won't want to be in it forever and a day. And so I guess we've accepted that, you know, at some point there will be an exit. Mm. And so I'm looking forward to that when it happens. But I do feel it's really important that you're not just seeking that exit and that you're enjoying it along the way. And, you know, having been in the business for 14 years now, I can say that I have done that.
All about enjoying the journey, not the destination.
Exactly. Yeah. And I continue to do that. And, you know, Smith is such a lovely brand and so many incredible brands out there want to work with us. And that always makes it very interesting. Mm. Okay. And we still have so much to do.
You do, indeed. But we'll come on to that. Okay, so Harry Potter or The Art of War by Sun Tzu?
I would read both.
Okay,
In fact, when we first launched our guidebooks, we outsold Harry Potter for one day in one store in the Waterstones in Piccadilly.
Yeah.
And then when they rang us up to tell us that, it was like a moment. It was a proper moment. And so when I had kids, I always kind of benchmarked Harry Potter and I was waiting for the day until they would read Harry Potter.
But have you ever outsold a Sun Tzu?
No.
Well, there you go. So, I think it's clear to say that there is a hierarchy. It's Sun Tzu, then Mr. and Mrs. Smith, and then Harry Potter. Okay. Fair? Yeah. Okay, the last film you watched that you loved?
I quite like action films. So I watched the last plane I was on, I watched The Last Born.
Was it good?
It was good. Yeah. You know, I think he does a great job. He does do a good job.
Favourite artist, music artist?
I like lots of eclectic music. So my husband was a DJ.
Okay.
So we listen to a very wide variety of music. We go to Glastonbury most years.
I do love Glastonbury.
And we're booked in to see the Kings of Leon at Hyde Park this year. So I'm really looking forward to seeing them.
Amazing.
So I wouldn't say I have a favourite artist. I flip between everything. I run to some happy house. So I'll listen to anything, really.
Do you? Grime
or...
Yeah, fair. do you actually set up a little boutique camping thing for Mr. and Mrs. Smith at Glastonbury? Have you ever thought about doing that?
No, we have thought about doing a festival. I'm not sure it would be Glastonbury.
Yeah, it's too intense.
I think it is too intense and a bit hardcore and a bit muddy. But I can see ourselves doing, in the future, some kind of pop-up hotel within a festival. I think that would be really fun.
I'm assuming you do glamping when you go, though, because that would be living the brand.
Yes.
Okay, just checking.
Yes.
Okay, entrepreneur that you look up to and admire?
Emma Sinclair is in my network, and I hope I can call her a friend now. She's just been so kind to me. I really respect what she does and how she tries to bring other women up behind.
And she's also amazingly direct.
I think there's Debbie Wasco went to university with, and she's just started a fund called Albright for Women. So that's those guys. Great.
Okay, what about your all-time hero? Obviously it doesn't have to have anything to do with entrepreneurship.
All-time hero, my mother.
Ah, sweet. Okay, well, moving on.
She is a classic entrepreneur
Is she?
Yeah.
What did she do then?
She started a dating agency around about 40 years ago.
Okay.
So it was before dating agencies were around. I think she was the second dating agency in the country.
Okay, that is a true entrepreneur.
And she started a company called, it was then called Country Partners, and she was finding farmers' wives, essentially. Because in the farming community, it's very, very difficult to meet people.
a problem that we've all gone through and everyone can relate to, naturally. Okay, so we'd like to start off the actual interview with the story behind the brand.
Yes.
So can you tell me how the brand came about?
My husband and I were looking for weekends away, trying to get out of London and just not finding anywhere except for the stock answer, which was, of course, Babington House. And we thought, well, there must be other places out there. They just don't have a voice. And there was one particularly, well, one very funny weekend where we'd booked this amazing property. We'd got the brochure through the post, because that's what you did then. You didn't look it up on the internet. You got the brochure of the hotel through the post, checked it out and thought, this is great. And it had a picture of somebody having a massage. We thought, that's what we want. It had a swimming pool just outside of London. So we got in the car, drove up, and the driveway was lovely. And we came into reception, and the receptionist kind of took us off into a little room to the side and in front of each other. And this is why it's really important to remember that we were dating and not married at that stage. In front of each other, she weighed us and took our blood pressure.
What?
And we were like, oh my God, that's embarrassing. Not, you know, the romantic start to a weekend that we wanted. Anyway, so we went up to the room and it was slightly disappointing. And James turned around.
Is anything disappointing after you've been weighed at check-in? Yeah. I mean, I feel like they do that to your life, but you're going to like everything from here on.
I think it was just that era where country house hotels hadn't moved on in the way that Babington House had. Okay. So the rooms, you know, you'd have swirly patterns on the carpet and swirly patterns on the walls and on the ceiling, and the hair dryers were stuck to the wall, and there was a Corby trouser press, and it was that era of fusty country house hotels. And so we just thought, okay, well, just throw money at the problem. Let's go down and let's glam up, have a really nice bottle of wine tonight, have a really nice meal. It looked like it had a really nice dining room, the hotel. So I did, I put my dress on and my heels on, and we sauntered down to the dining room, and everybody else in the dining room was in their bathrobes. And we sat down, and of course it was a calorie-controlled menu with no alcohol. And so we just sat up and went, this is just not what we're looking for.
Yeah.
And we snuck out like naughty school children, past reception, down to the pub for a pie and a pint.
Good.
And you know, it was a couple of weekends after that that we went to the Lake District, and again, just had a very disappointing weekend. And we sat in the local Pizza Express, because of course we hadn't booked the hotel in time, and sat there, and on my Palm Pilot, that will date it, that's how long ago it was, we wrote out exactly what we would want to know from the guidebook. And that was, you know, not where the nearest rock formation was, but things like the thread count of the sheets, and, you know, can you get two in the bath, will the shower get me wet, can the barman mix me a perfect martini?
Yeah.
All the kind of important things that make up your experience of the weekend.
Yeah.
And were kind of speaking to us as a kind of young 30-something couple. And so that's how Mr. and Mrs. Smith was born.
And the name?
Mr. and Mrs. Smith is that kind of post-war, when people were starting to have money again, starting to go away for weekends again, it was the name that you would sign in the guest book if you were with somebody outside of wedlock, even if you were planning on marrying them, because it was so frowned upon
in
those days.
Have you ever checked in as Mr. and Mrs. Smith?
We haven't, actually, no.
Oh, come on, that's a sense of fun. That's like an obvious thing you've got to do at least once.
Well, the way it works with Mr. and Mrs. Smith is that we go and find the hotels, we curate them.
Yeah.
So in fact, we don't want to go incognito. We want to go in and we want to get to know the owner, the general manager. We want to see every single room that we possibly can, get under the skin of the hotel and understand it to see if it's the kind of hotel that we want to recommend.
Okay.
It's then that we send the anonymous reviewers to back up the integrity of
that. So presumably you have to pay for the anonymous viewers to stay in those hotels, because otherwise they would know and it's all obvious. But presumably you also get a lot of freebies as a corporate culture with the hotels.
Of course. Yeah, and then, you know, and of course, when we go to a hotel, you know, we don't get the same experience, which is why we need to send the anonymous reviewer.
That makes a lot of sense.
But is it without, you know, an anonymous reviewer can just enjoy the experience and the service. What we do is really try and understand the hotel and understand whether it's the kind of thing that we want to recommend.
And just for anyone that hasn't quite put two and two together, in your own words, Mr. and Mrs. Smith is
So I would like to think of it as a travel club for boutique hotel lovers.
Okay, and why do you position it that way? What is so important about calling it a travel club?
Because I think that we're united not just by the type of hotels that we look after, and now villas, but it's a tribe of people. It's a tribe of people who like this type of hotel. And it doesn't have to be a particular style. It just has to be, it's almost like a cult around not wanting cookie cutter.
And have you done much merchandise or anything like that? I can imagine like having a very passionate fan base that would be very proud to represent. No?
Yes, we've done, as in kind of products.
Yeah,
so we've done, we did a mattress with Swoon.
Did you?
Like the best Smith mattress.
That's funny.
we've talked about doing linen for a very long time, like, you know, bedroom linen.
So I can imagine a bit like the Soho House vibe, right? But that's obviously all owned by Soho House, and this could be a bit more of a, you know, a bit more of an interesting opportunity for retail, for sure.
I agree. It's something we haven't done properly.
Sure.
And
but you've dabbled in, and it's, is there somewhere as a potential?
Yeah, I mean, it would almost be a completely other business.
Absolutely.
And Nick Jones is amazing. I mean, it's incredible what he manages to do.
Yes.
But we have quite a challenging business in the travel industry. And without a large amount of investment, we have to focus our energies on that business. And so, you know, I would love to have a products business as well.
Have you ever been tempted to raise money on a product-based business? I know it would be completely separate, but then at the same time, like you say, it would need a capital raise, and that's a good thing, because it would be separated almost. Has that ever crossed your mind?
Yes, it has. It has. Yeah. And
because obviously the Nick Jones thing is a bit of an unfair comparison for you, because they own those buildings,
they own the
or the leases or whatever. So it is a different thing, right? And he raises his money based on that, and you're a technology company with great, you know, curation. It's a very different business model.
Very different, yeah.
A lot less risky, at least, in theory. Okay, so why did you actually start a business? What were you solving? Like, you mentioned the whole thing about, you know, going away with your husband, but at the same time, you know, does that big curation element behind boutique hotels and stuff, isn't some of the almost enjoyment for the person to go away and try? Isn't that sort of surprise? And I know obviously you can be disappointed sometimes, but isn't there an element of that that's kind of part of the fun?
Yes, but I don't think at Mr. and Mrs. Smith that we give away the fun. So, you know, even the first book, we were the very first guidebook not to have just a picture of a swimming pool or, you know, a beach on the front.
Yeah.
It was. I remember it very well, and I remember shooting it at Blake's, and it was a door that was just very half ajar. So you could just see in the background the kind of four-poster bed and the very lush, dark colours of Blake's. And on the back, there was the back of the door with a peephole. So Mr. and Mrs. Smith has always been about evoking the kind of weekend that you might have.
And curiosity.
Yes, and curiosity into it. And giving you not too much detail. I mean, I think some of these guidebooks just give you so much that you need a holiday to read the guidebook.
Yeah.
You know, you don't, and people just don't have time these days. And so we didn't. We literally said to people, all the important things that they needed to know, what the dress code was, so you know what to pack. There's nothing worse than going somewhere and feeling that you haven't packed, you know, the right clothes, or that the dining room is way too glamorous for the things that you've packed, and you've only packed jeans. So all the important information. We have a little section that says worth getting out of bed for, and it's a small paragraph of like things that you definitely need to do in the area if you're going. And so I think you know, there was, we didn't give anything away. We didn't give too much away, and we still don't.
Yeah.
But, you know, people like to research, and you know, when you've got very little free time, getting your time right on holiday, getting that hotel address right is really important.
True, you don't want wasted minutes.
Exactly.
And has the actual, has the original vision changed at all, or the business model, or, you know, have you had to adapt that a lot over 14 years? Because it's a long time.
So the business model changed entirely.
Right,
so we pivoted year two
But that was from publishing to online.
From
correct?
Publishing to online.
And since being online, has it had to pivot again?
No, we haven't. We've expanded our product portfolio. So we went into Mr. and Mrs. Smith was always very much about couples and still is. But we expanded into the family travel arena. Mm. And then last year we bought a villa company.
Okay.
So we've added villas to the product portfolio, which is great. And that gives
us
another.
Is it global? Just Europe?
At the moment, we have villas in Italy, in the UK, Ibiza and Mallorca.
Okay.
But we'll be expanding that to Bali and the Caribbean.
Lovely. What's it called? Soon.
It's just
Mistress and Mistress Villas. Okay. Just checking. Wait for SEO, obviously. Okay, so you've been running Mr. and Mrs. Smith now for 14 years.
Yes.
And arguably don't really look any older than me, which is surely a sign of me looking like a beautiful young lady.
You say all the right things,
of course. What were you actually doing before that then? It's 14 years. I mean, you just wouldn't know that. I mean, like genuinely, you don't really look like you're entirely older than 30. So what were you doing?
So sweet.
What were you doing before you were 16 and started this business?
So my first job out of university, I launched an energy drink in Brazil. And
I'm really glad you're going to mention that, because I was going to push you on the Brazil story in case you weren't going to bring it up, because it's an excellent one.
It's a good story. I mean, I'll just say it briefly and not go into it in too much detail.
Sure.
But it was the opportunity of a lifetime to go out with just one other person who was my boss, and to launch a product into a country where within 9 months, we had distribution deals with Schweppes. We changed the product slightly to adjust to the sweetness of the tooth of the Brazilian market. We'd got all our marketing in order. I had an amazing time going out to find out where our distribution should be, especially in all the nightclubs. Unfortunately, after 9 months, the company ran out of money, and so I had to come home and start again.
And what did you start again with?
So I thought, well, I should obviously get a proper job. Having kind of failed, I thought I'd failed at this one. It wasn't my fault, but I'd kind of come back going, oh, well, you know, that didn't go so well. Maybe I need to, you know, learn.
How old were you at this point?
Must have been 22.
And was that really hard on you, or did you kind of bounce back from it quickly?
No, I just realised I needed to do something, you know, serious, and perhaps not indulge my love of travel so much. I mean, travel has always been a part of my life, even from when I was very, very young. My parents divorced when I was 10, 11, and so I had to get on a plane to come and see my father in England.
I read somewhere that was the best part of the divorce for you.
I just, you know, being on that airplane with that lanyard round my neck, you know, being taken by very glamorous air hostesses and going into the cockpit and seeing it, I loved it.
Mm.
I loved it. And I vowed I'd always, you know, travel from then on. But I did realise that I needed to get a trade and I needed to learn. So when I came back from Brazil, I went into Honda, into the marketing side, but kind of in the technology side as well. So I was ordering the cars from the three factories and using various spreadsheets and running macros between the spreadsheets. So it was all a little bit complex. And then I moved agency side, and we were doing things for Unilever and Ford, building databases. I was very involved with one of the guys there on the CRM side.
Did you have a maths background?
No, I was good with maths, but I did languages at university.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, where did all this... jumping ahead, obviously, but where does your background take you to become the CTO of your company? That's an unusual jump. For starters, very few female CTOs. Obviously, not enough women in technology in general and studying STEM, and that's a problem that other people are trying to solve currently, which is great, and I imagine you're probably a big supporter of. Far less so, even a CTO level. So how does that happen without a technology background? What's the story behind it for you?
So, I mean, it started there with the spreadsheets. It really did. And then from then on, I was always in the data and data management side of marketing. I was never above the line marketing. It was always about data, building databases. And so, you know, from the very start, when we did the first guidebook, we had a card in the front of the book. Because I realized that, you know, if we wanted to talk to and be able to sell our second book to a customer, you know, I had to capture them myself. I couldn't rely, because Waterstones weren't going to give me the customer base.
Yeah.
So we had a card in the front of the book, and you went onto just a single page site, and people would enter their details.
Yeah.
So I understood about data capture from the very beginning. And it kind of grew from there. When we decided to go into the online booking technology, of course, I didn't know what I was doing. And so we outsourced that bit. And I spent 2 years getting underneath the skin of that booking technology and realizing what a pile of rubbish it was.
Yeah, sure.
and realizing that we could do better.
Yep.
And that we needed something bespoke for us, because our hotels were different. You know, we needed to cater or to create technology for hotels that, well, we had one hotel that was 3 rooms. And still wrote all reservations down in a book. Right. We still have hotels that write reservations down in a book.
Sure.
All
the way CTO's to dream.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that.
All the way to very sophisticated, you know, London, New York hotels,
yeah,
who revenue, probably yield manage and revenue manage, and, you know, manage their rates on an hourly, minute by minute basis. And, you know, to very large complexity. So travel is a very complex technology and data business, because you have so many iterations.
Yeah.
If you think about putting a couple or a family into a hotel bedroom at a certain point in time, you know, if they book for 2 nights versus 5 nights, the nightly rate can change. The age of their child will also affect the price, because if they're in a cot or in an extra bed, mm-hmm, if they need the size of the room, you know, if they're staying over a weekend, if they're staying just, you know, midweek, all of these different things can affect the price of the room.
Yeah.
And the configuration. So it is highly complex. And so I spent 2 years looking at what the technology was doing and saying, you know, we can do this better. And so I gave them notice and sat down with the developer, and we architected and built our own system.
And you never looked back. Wanted to be the CTO ever since. You never been tempted to be like COO, or are you organized?
We don't have a COO.
Okay, so you kind of, it like you guys just do all sorts?
Yeah, so my husband was CEO and now he's chairman.
Right.
And then we have our third partner, who is always on the finance side.
Yeah.
He's now CEO.
Okay.
I'm quite happy. I love the technical side.
Yeah.
I'm a problem solver.
Yeah.
So I look at something, I go, how can we solve this with technology?
Okay.
And
makes sense.
I love the back end booking system. I'm okay with the front end, but, you know, I have a product person,
that,
and
yeah,
you know, my husband, sure, is perfect to kind of, you know, I don't care whether it's red or green or blue.
Right, understood.
I care whether
he's the brand guy, therefore also involved in UX and product.
Yeah, he chooses the wallpaper at home.
So okay, so
and I make the TV work.
That is what you always expect to hear from gender bias couples. There. Okay, so more boring questions, but we will get them out of the way. What do you feel about, we touched on it earlier, the whole, there's two questions really for you that are, I guess, like probably most commonly asked. One is about the female technologist and the other is female entrepreneur. Do you feel like those are actively things that you like to participate in and drive change in? Or do you feel like it shouldn't be drawn attention to because best person for the job is gender irrelevant? So where do you sort of stand on the whole debate?
I think we need to encourage more women into technology and into entrepreneurship, because, you know, having a balance is always good.
Mm.
And, you know, I think what I struggle with is why women aren't going more into technology, because I think it should have been the industry that women just, you know, take over because we are problem solvers. It should be our sweet spot.
Mm.
And yet women aren't, you know, choosing that or and in some places still not being encouraged to do so. And so I think that anything that we can do to encourage, you know, and help women understand what it is a good thing.
Because I don't think it has anything to do with an ability level, for example.
No,
but I don't mean ability like capability. What I mean is, you know, it's highly mathematical, but there's so many women working in really technical jobs in finance.
Mm.
And I mean, I know there's also, you know, more men working in finance than women, but there are plenty of women. The gender balance isn't so bad there. But technology should be just as attractive an opportunity, and you need just as highly analytical, capable, I wouldn't say mathematicians necessarily, but it's a very similar mindset, right?
Yeah.
So I never really understood the difference.
There are lots of jobs around you. Women don't have to code. You can still be in technology and be that problem solver.
Project manager or product manager.
Amazing.
And a leader. So
you're basically...
So yes,
you're...
and women entrepreneurs, do I like to get involved? So that's my sweet spot. I like helping women... who are starting out, if I can.
And that's as an angel investor generally, or mentoring as well? What do you actually do actively
I'm not a big investor and I'm not an angel, as it were.
Sure.
But I have dabbled in a couple of things. And when I've done it because I've met somebody who I think is great.
And you just want to be there
and
to
I just
them.
Want to be able to help them.
Sure.
Because I'm getting to the stage now where... there's still a lot of challenges with Mr. and Mrs. Smith, but I do have a bit more spare time. So I do take on a few other bits and pieces. So I'm just about to join the board at the Travel Tech Lab at the Trampery, because I can definitely help in the travel tech space for the startups coming through, which is great. And there are a couple of young women who I've put some money into and am helping. Just purely because I can open up my contacts and I can see how I can help them.
Did you have help on the way like that?
No.
And is the lack of it something that you're like, you know what, it just would have been so much easier. I want to change that part of the journey for that person.
Yes, it would have been a lot easier had we had that kind of help. But when we started out, you know, there weren't these incubators, there weren't these places, these networks where you could go and meet, you know, people like me. And I'm not sure we knew what we were getting into either. But had we had advice earlier on, it could have prevented us from falling into some of the pitfalls we did fall into along the way.
Which is fair. I think a flip side of it is it's so popular, entrepreneurship, at the moment, that it's also 100 times more competitive in a way.
Mm.
And there's not necessarily more money going around. I mean, there's always the same technically same pool of money. And the SEIS and EIS investment schemes have been around for a long time now.
Yes, they have.
There's more and more opportunities to distribute. So it is a lot tougher. There's a lot more separating wheat from the chaff. But I think it's interesting, you know, speaking, for example, for yourself and with Sarah, you know, the time when you started up, definitely outliers, definitely unique to start a business at that time, really. It just wasn't the infrastructure. We're even talking on the level of, you know, things that my company would take for granted, which is AWS cloud servers, don't need to spend. Graham Hobson from Photobox is a hilarious story about how like almost their entire original investment was spent on physical servers that they had to just get in, and a huge amount of money. So I think there's a lot of that.
They had to move our server. And so shut us down. And so, you know, literally they were moving a box.
Yeah, it's crazy. Final question actually around, which just I thought of whilst you were talking, is you've got a massive passion for travel and you love everything to do with travel, but arguably travel is one of the hardest industries to make money in, according to just about every single person that's ever worked in travel.
That is true.
And I wanted to know your perspective on that. Is the pursuit of how to be profitable and successful in travel worth all of the stress? Or do you sometimes wish you could apply your passion, interest, and ability into another industry?
Good question. The problem with travel, especially if you're an intermediary, are the margins.
Yeah.
So you are scrabbling around for, you know, really rubbish margins. And so if I had my time again, with the knowledge, I would definitely look for, you know, if it was or wasn't in travel, an opportunity where I would have big margins to play with. If you have the big margins, then your flexibility and your ability to do stuff is just so much greater. Mm. Whereas, you know, if you've got very small margins, then you have to scale. But I wouldn't let that deter people from going into travel, because travel is it is the most amazing industry, and I wouldn't live without the travel.
But your next business, something to do with travel, or try a whole
travel or hospitality. Hospitality, yeah.
Do you see yourself owning your own hotel one day?
So this was something that we wanted to do for a very, very long time.
I want you to do it. I think it makes sense. I bet a lot of people that know your story want you to do it.
We have a little black book, and it contains all the things from all the hotels we've been to, which we add to. It's not a physical black book. It's actually a Google Doc, but nowadays.
Call it a black book. Yeah. It's fine. I'm reading off a black book as we speak.
And it has everything, but not just the things that we liked. All the little things that really annoyed us whenever we go into a hotel, from, you know, where the plug points are to, you know, showers not getting you, not having blue or red or anything that you can tell which way it is to get hot and cold. But all the tiny little touch points, you know, if you actually built the hotel that is in that book, you would never be able to do it, because the detail is just crazy. But for many, many years, we thought, that's where we're heading. You know, we'll
create the world's best hotel.
But as I've got older, I've realised just how hard doing a hotel is, and I so admire the hoteliers that, you know, get it right, because you are touching a customer in a thousand different ways, and it is so tough to get it right all the time.
Yeah.
And so I'm not sure that now...
It's worth the stress.
But something maybe in hospitality or...
Could you do a partnership?
Maybe.
Okay. I'm thinking of all this for you, because I want you to have one.
There's some really cool unique boutiques,
right? And like those boutiques were really well funded. And, you know, I could sort of imagine there's like a partnership there.
So my husband sits on the board of an estate that have various properties, and I think he loves that and planning what their next thing is without being involved in it.
Okay, so this next part is all about you rather than the brand, so you can relax a bit more because there's no wrong answer. And to make you super relaxed to begin with, I read you grew up in Ibiza.
Yes.
So do I assume that you grew up on a cocktail of MDMA and vodka? Or was it the other side of the island where it was more holistic and spiritual?
Very much more the holistic, spiritual side. So in fact, I'd never been to the party side of the island. Even though it's a tiny island.
Yeah, I've heard this from people that live there, that you almost don't know that it happens.
It wasn't a part of our life. It was the area where the tourists came, and our life was completely separate. I didn't even go to the English school. So I went to the convent, the Spanish convent on the island, and I hardly spoke any English.
Okay.
And so I was very removed from
absolutely no
the
Spanish accent whatsoever. It was just unusual.
Elocution lessons.
Really?
When I
came
back.
Fascinating. Okay.
Yeah, I had to play a year of catch up.
Okay.
When I came back, hated it.
But I mean,
just wanted to be on the beach.
That's really odd. So I mean, there's nothing. But presumably you speak Spanish absolutely fluently, and you sound like a native there.
Yes.
Okay. That's cool. How much of your life was that up until
12? At the age of 12, we came back to the UK.
And was that incredibly disappointing for you? It was another island.
It was horrible.
It's just a slightly bigger island.
Yeah.
But...
we ended up in Leamington Spa, and it was horrible. It was really horrible. I hated it. For a year, I had to have extra... I could only take the maths exam that year, which must have been the 13-plus or whatever exam.
Yeah.
Yes, I had to have extra English lessons. I had to have extra lessons in everything because I was so behind and couldn't speak the language, basically. But at that age, you kind of pick it up easily. And after a year, I was okay.
Okay.
And had kind of settled into English life. But there's something in me that, and I guess this is why I always need to escape. So So there's always something, some travel planned.
Mm.
I feel this need to just get away.
Because London is the best place to travel from, because it's so well connected. So that's incredibly valuable. I actually read as well that you live near Heathrow, correct?
Yes, yes. We moved to West London to be near Heathrow because we were on the plane. So.
Yeah, I love that. That's unusual but good. Does make a lot of sense. You seem like a very happy person. Have I just always caught you on a good day?
I am a happy person, yes.
What actually gets you down? Do different things get you down now to those when you were starting up years ago, or do you just not really get down?
I think that when you're talking about the business, the worries are different. So, you know, I used to stay up worrying at night that, you know, when we were a startup that we couldn't pay our employees and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And now the worries are different. They're kind of bigger. I can't look at the employee bill because it's just too much money.
Yeah.
we've got 120 staff, so that would just, I don't know. You just don't look at it. Until it comes to budgeting.
By the way, that is not advice for entrepreneurs. Never look at your wage bill.
No. You need to know when you're a company. But we have an accounts team now that look at it all the time, so I don't need to. So now the worries and the stresses are different. What gets me down? I'm always a positive person.
Good. Okay.
But my family being unhappy, I mean, that would be...
Sure. But that's like normal life stuff. But like on a day-to-day, generally very sunny side up.
Yes.
Okay. What motivates you?
I love problem solving. Okay. I do love coming, apart from the travel, which I've already mentioned quite a lot.
Sure.
I love my team and I love seeing them get stuff done. I'm like any developer, I love a tick list and a project, and I love Jira.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Do you love Jira's getting acquisition? Stuff done. Was it Jira that bought Trello? I think it was.
Oh, was it?
I use Trello.
We've never used Trello.
We get all our. It's a classic dev team thing. It's like some of them are on Basecamp, some of them are on Trello, some of them are on Jira, and Jira just buying Trello, and then the argument starts. Like, wait, which one of us is right then? Like, which one are we going to end up using?
Uh-huh.
It's a particularly nerdy chat, which I don't really engage with because I just use Trello.
Well, at some point, you stop using freebie options and you actually move to Jira.
Yeah, does make sense. How would you describe yourself?
Independent. Positive.
Yeah.
A mum. Runner. And travel addict.
Okay, good. It's a weird question, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. Sarah was basically unable to answer it, pretty much. They really just caught her by surprise. But yeah, I think it's one of the hardest questions you can actually ask someone. But if we, even harder than that, is if we asked a really good friend of yours to describe you, what do you think they'd say?
Independent.
Yeah.
No, I don't know.
What do you want to know?
Yes.
Okay, good. Let's save you from the awkwardness of the fear of what might be said. So we asked your friend Kate, and she said, so I asked, how would you describe Tam as a person? And she said that you're incredibly loving and loyal, steady, determined, disciplined, and a complete rock. She has the best giggle of anyone I know, and when she starts to laugh, she can end up in hysterics. It doesn't happen very often, but when it does, it's gold. She's also annoyingly clever and really good at anything she tries her hand at. She can eat and drink for England and still be skinny, and she can run marathons and do handstands and yoga, as well as run a family and a successful business without breaking a sweat. I mean, if I didn't love her to bits, frowny face. Does that sound fair? It does sound fair. She also told me about a time when I was asking her, do you have any embarrassing stories about Tam or anything that's, you know, slightly unusual she won't bring up herself. She mentioned the time that they were going on your hen and you forgot your passport.
Yeah.
And that you were absolutely chilled about the whole thing, and actually just they got everyone else, made it everyone else's problem to try and make sure that passport came to you in time, which, as she's commented, of course it did, because it's you and nothing ends up going wrong. Because she believes you have this kind of charmed existence where even when things go wrong, they still end up right.
You would think that, you know, traveling quite a bit, that I'd be quite a good traveler.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's chaotic.
She also told me about a time when you were at Oxford together doing languages, and you went to, you went to Chile, and she went to Argentina, and she said, I called her from the place I was staying, which was a windowless studio room, to discuss going to see a total lunar eclipse in the Andes. She was staying in a mansion with a swimming pool with six gorgeous men as housemates. I ditched Argentina immediately and went to share her room in Chile. We were a bit of a sensation. The guys thought we were lesbians and it was hilarious. We played along only because it made us laugh. She was also responsible for making me jump out of a plane in a tandem skydive 10,000 feet above Santiago. San Diego would have been just as interesting, a bit more unusual almost.
I know, I landed on my feet. She was right to come over.
Yeah,
we had the most amazing house.
That sounds brilliant. Okay, so what does a typical day look like for you? What kind of shit do you get done in a day?
So I wear two hats.
Yeah,
I've got my founder of a business that, and whatever goes along with that. So sometimes I'll have press meetings, sometimes I'll be doing a big partnership. So I did the big partnership that we have with British Airways. We have others that we're dealing with right now as well, new ones coming on board.
Yeah.
So I do a bit of that kind of new business just because it's important for, you know,
a figurehead
to be there at the start of a relationship. So lots of press meetings, or it could be a board meeting. I'll sit in. I quite like, because my brain works that way, I quite like PPC.
Yeah, okay.
And so I tend to sit in on some of the, I'm just thinking about what happened yesterday. I sat in on the agency meeting for the PPC.
That's incredibly nosy and detailed for someone who should be having a helicopter view, but fair enough. Just says more about you.
I set up and used to run the Smith PPC account. Sure. We didn't, you know, in the day when we didn't have anybody else to run it. And I found it very addictive. Because it's like gambling, bidding. So, and because it's lots of numbers and adverts and spreadsheets and bid strategies and quality scores and kind of that kind of appeals to my brain.
Yeah.
And so I really love it. And so I can, you know, sometimes can't quite let go. So I'd sit in a meeting like that. But that's all kind of the founder role.
Yeah.
And on the other side, I have my tech team. And we have six backenders, a sysadmin, integrations manager, four front end, product manager, three full-time picture editors, a designer.
Big team.
It's a big team.
Four front enders is quite a surprising amount as well. Sounds like quite a lot. Do you do loads of iterations?
We're constantly tweaking the site. Okay. Yeah. And we have the Mr. and Mrs. Smith site, but we also have the Smith and Family site. So it's quite a lot going on.
Yeah, okay, I understand.
And and then we have the app. So so my day to day will be, you know, looking over the projects, making sure that the projects are all on track, working with my head of development, helping him with any team issues if there are any that need my help.
Okay, this moves us on to the third and final part of the interview, which is lessons and failures. Now, of course, you've not had any failures, so don't worry about it. But 14 years in one company, and let's just say potentially not everything's gone smoothly, because it never does. Are you willing to share any honest war stories that still scar you?
Yes. I mean, I think right now we have both online and offline. So we invested quite heavily a few years ago in an offline travel team, which are people on the phones to customers.
Right, okay.
They're split 50-50% on sales and inspiration. So you can ring up and they'll find a hotel for you anywhere in the world, and 50% support. So we're there for you if things go wrong. And this going back to the travel club, you know, providing a service for customers is really important to us. And at the start of that journey, we were quite reluctant to start building the in-house team because we hadn't run like a travel agency on the phones before, you know, a call centre. We never called them a call centre because it's, you know, it's all open plan office. But we didn't have any expertise in that area. And so we outsourced that. We outsourced it to a company who had been in the business for 30 years, had been doing, you know, offline travel, really great NPS scores, all that kind of stuff. And we thought, well, at least our customers will be safe with them. You know, they'll treat them right. And it was an absolute disaster. We were there for a year.
That's been unbelievably disappointing when you make an active choice for someone with a great Net Promoter score, etc., and you could have done it better yourself after all.
Exactly. And it was just, you know, it was a great learning, because essentially what the mismatch had been, they just didn't understand our customers.
Yeah.
And they didn't understand our hotels.
Yeah.
So they were getting a young 30-something customer who wanted to stay in the funky boutique hotel in Berlin and trying to sell them cruises.
Right, got you.
You know, and it was just, there was a complete, that's a very extreme example.
Yeah, sure.
It was that kind of thing. It was just a really not a fit, and they didn't understand that young customer and what they want.
But
as a couple.
And did you have experience in that, or was the outcome, you lost a lot of customers, you got a lot of complaints? Was there really like a hard hitting?
We did lose customers during that period because they were going, well, this is not what I expect from Mr. and Mrs. Smith. And then we started to bring it in-house, and it's one of the best things that, you know, that we did.
Okay.
What
simple mistakes have you made that you hope other people listening can avoid? Like super simple stuff.
So globalization, I touched on that with the travel center, but it was also, you know, as well as having the travel team, the call center out in Melbourne, we wanted to break into that market. And I think that we did that way too soon. And we should have just firmed up our UK proposition. I think we wasted a lot of money in Australia.
Okay,
so globalization.
Consolidate before expanding.
Yeah, it makes sure that you've got a solid base before you go spending a lot of money in other countries. Mm. And get properly funded to do that project. You know, we kind of self-funded out.
Sure, got
Australia
you.
And
makes it much riskier.
You know, we ended up pulling back, so it was a big mistake in the end, I guess.
Do you? I mean, you must meet quite a lot of entrepreneurs, I guess. Like, what are the typical traits that you see that actually annoy you, or you think that people are doing wrong, and you kind of want to help steer them to do it better? Like, does that happen quite often?
No, because I don't have enough knowledge of their industries to know that they're doing it right or wrong.
Right.
I wouldn't presume to know that. I admire the entrepreneurs who just get up and do it and keep going, and you know, just have that, you know, courage of their own convictions and get stuff done.
Yeah.
It's
like self-confidence and hustle.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay. What companies do you really admire? And this is an important question, because Mr. and Mrs. Smith is top of most people's list. If they know the company in the first place, that skyrockets them to the top of their list. So it's really interesting to know what kind of companies you admire. Are there companies inside the company that you talk about and admire from like a corporate point of view? Or is it more like a personal, this is how you think?
Yeah, it's a good question. The one that immediately springs to mind is Matches.
Okay. Yeah.
I think they've done an amazing job.
Yeah.
Not only that, I think they're doing so well now at that content marketing piece. So not only are they hugely profitable, very well funded, and that was a couple behind the brand as well.
Yeah, in Wimbledon, right?
Yeah. So I think they've done extremely well. And we're doing content pieces with them, and I know their content team, and it's, you know, the SEO, the power, the people that they managed to draw in, I think they've really cracked that content marketing piece.
Okay, so a very fascinating interview from an utterly charming lady who has basically managed to take her brand completely global through minimal amounts of funding, and just to make sure that she can get to the office and anywhere she's required to go on time. Just moved her family home to Heathrow, which is...
That's a very good life hack. I think that's probably the ultimate life hack. If you travel a lot, basically move to one of those airport hotels.
I feel like that's probably why a lot of us boring geeks just move the office to Old Street, because, you know, it's sort of the other technology, laptops everywhere.
Yeah.
That's all we need. But she actually has to fly on planes, and I really enjoyed the bit about, you know, learning about her upbringing on planes as well. It's funny how that kind of impact of her childhood led to exactly the lifestyle she created for herself.
So who have we got next week?
Pretty different guest, to be honest. It's not one of the better name, you know, big brand entrepreneurs, but actually
Big personality.
Big personality. So particularly if you've been living in London in the technology scene and have any interest in growth hacking, you will have seen the personal brand that is formerly known as Vincent Dignan and now known as Vin Clancy.
A rebrand.
Yeah, exactly. It's a lot like the artist formerly known as Prince.
Yes.
Which I think I have actually called it once. And Vin is an utterly divisive character. He is hated by many and absolutely adored by many. And I think that's actually part of his appeal. Whether you love him or hate him, he's definitely an interview worth listening to. If you're looking for actionable and practical tactics and steps to get dirty growth hacking marketing tips from a single podcast episode, this is the one for you. So tune in next week. And in the meantime, I hope you have a lovely week at home.
And before we go, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, SoundCloud. You can find us on YouTube, and you can also find all the historic episodes on our website, which is secretleaders.com. If you've got any ideas or feedback or any comments, just email us at hello@secretleaders.com. So we'll see you next week.
Thank you. Goodbye.